Oh yes, and what a show we have in store for you today. Hello, welcome to this edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine show. I'm Michael Hoge, your host. Glad to have you with us on this lovely Monday morning, and it is lovely out there as you listen to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. What a busy weekend it was. Comic-Con was going on downtown. The basketball tournament was going on downtown. The ballet was going on downtown, Quality Hill Playhouse, the Rep had a show downtown, and all over town other plays were opening and going on. Busy, busy weekend for entertainment in Kansas City, and we're glad to have kind of helped inform you about some of those things as we go along the way. Other shows are opening in other parts of the area today. We're going to talk about one of those shows in the first half of the program today out in Lee's Summit, where they have the Summit Theater now, and it's, I'm going to guess, third year by now. Third year, gentlemen?
I think we're in the fourth year.
Fourth year going on at the Summit Theater of Lee Summit, Missouri, where they have the serious intellectual comedy. No, it's called Le Picasso at the La Pina Gil, written by actor, comedian, and intellectual, as you'll find out, Steve Martin. Yes, that wild and crazy guy, Steve Martin,
yes,
wrote some plays.
Seriously funny.
he's very seriously funny. Of course he is. Now I'm going to switch. Okay. Now say that again.
Oh, it's very seriously funny.
Yeah. Finally, I have the right microphone.
There's going to be a whole lot of silence.
That's right. That is the voice of Emerson Rapp. He plays the role of Albert Einstein.
Hello.
In the show.
Yes, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to have you with us here today. This is an interesting play. Oh, Adam Arterbridge, the director. How dare I forget the director?
Well, that's okay.
Adam Arterbridge, the director, is. I should give some credits to. He is the director. Recent directing credits include Boing Boing, All My Sons, Proof. Now, there's a very serious play.
Yes,
indeed.
It was.
And as a performer, performed in Avenue Q. One of the, I guess the Barn Players has that coming up as mm-hmm. well. Very
yep.
well soon.
Yeah.
Interesting play to do as well.
Yeah.
A lot
yeah,
of fun.
It's a blast, yeah.
Going on. Welcome to the show. This is your first time, second time here?
Oh, this is the second time with you.
Second
yeah, we spoke together when I directed Proof.
Yeah. Proof. Yeah, that was a very interesting play, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it's a great play.
Sad in some ways. All that intellect, as in this play, you know, just shocked full of intellect. And Emerson Rapp is with us as well, plays the role of Albert Einstein. Now, that's a challenge.
Yeah, yes. let me tell you, it's hard to kind of get into the mind of someone, but fortunately for my day job, I'm an engineer, so it's like, uh-huh. okay, I hang out with enough nerds, anyway, but not nearly enough nerds that really just kind of understand his intellect. So for me, and it's just really having fun with the role, and like, it's like, all right, how is he thinking like this entire time? How did he come up with that thought process too? So, you know, it's a fun character to get into. And then everyone has the idea of Einstein in their mind already. So now I have that worry to try to live up to their expectations.
Yeah.
It's like, I know how Einstein looks.
You
know Einstein.
Equals energy times the speed of light squared. Something
yes.
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he came up with that theory.
It's pretty smart. I couldn't think of it like that.
Did he spend a lot of time in Paris?
You know, I don't know if he spent a lot of time in Paris. I know he spent a lot of time in Germany, and then, fortunately, he spent a lot of time in America, too.
That's right. Yeah, became a college professor.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of
like,
an absent-minded. He was the model for the later-to-come absent-minded professor.
Absent-minded. And it's like, man, I know he knows a lot, but trying to reach into that, I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah,
overnight.
Getting that across to the students might have been difficult.
Yeah.
I don't know. You'd have to be at his level, I think.
I can imagine a lot of failing students in his
class. Oh, if I were him, I would know that I was above. Not that I'm comparing myself.
Well, yeah.
If I were him, I would know that I would be above most people's levels. It would be hard for me to give them a failing mark.
Mm-hmm.
I would just. Are they following it as best they can?
Right. I bet he would explain all the time. It was like, why can't you just understand this?
That's right.
Like, well, I don't know. I just never thought of it like that.
That's right. That would be hard to translate across. But this is the La Pina Gil was a, I guess you described it earlier as a bar.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's exactly
a
what it was.
French bar.
A bar / cabaret. It was in Montmartre in Paris.
Paris?
It's a real place.
Yeah.
It's still there. You can go visit if you want. I think it's a little more popular now than it was then.
Sure.
Just for its historic value. But
that's
yeah, it was
right.
a place where artists would come. It was in that part of town. And Pablo Picasso actually did frequent that bar. There's no necessarily evidence, as far as I know, that Albert Einstein visited there as well.
Well, they would be kind of a different era.
Yeah.
Who would be older? I guess Picasso would have been.
No, Einstein's a touch older, but one of the key facets of the play is that we meet both men just when they're on the cusp of greatness. We're about a year out from Einstein publishing his special theory of relativity, and then about 3 years out from Picasso painting La Demoiselle d'Avignon, which is kind of the beginning of his Rosé period and his best work.
Yeah. So in the mind of Steve Martin, comic genius, really, an intellectual in his own way, although that's really not apparent all of his characters,
but he really is.
He's also a musician. He has a banjo group, which is played in the area here. I believe it was the Uptown Theater. Mm-hmm. So he travels with and then writes as well, and has written several plays, along with his comedy routines.
Oh, he's such a great comedian, writer, actor to be able to do all of these things too. I mean, you're talking about a spark of genius right there.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's just having all these ideas and it's like, well, I just got to try a little bit of everything too.
So. If he were here, I think I would ask him, did you imagine yourself meeting Einstein or Picasso or any others that may have frequented the Lapine Agile in Paris?
Yeah, I mean, and so much of the play is about sort of the value of genius and talent and what that means to the course of humanity. And I mean, I think it's apropos that it was written by probably one of our great comic geniuses of the modern era, at least, for sure.
Did Steve frequent that place when he went to Paris?
I imagine he did. I don't know for sure. I think a lot of the elements that he took to put into the show are from the specific work of the people that he's dealing with and that sort of thing. But he's very well traveled, so I'm sure he's been there plenty.
Yeah, so imagine an establishment in Paris where people go to relax, have a few drinks and talk, and some of the great geniuses of our time wander in there to talk. Interesting concept right there. Okay. For a lot of existential type conversations.
Oh yeah.
Perhaps.
I could just imagine. Well, and, you know, we're talking about how it's kind of their formative years of Einstein, Picasso. So, you know, they're not dead set in their ways. So they're kind of discovering things as they talk to each other, too. So just imagine if someone who's, you know, so enlightened scientifically and someone who's so enlightened artistically just start talking. It's like, how are we sharing these ideas? Or how are we, like, we kind of imagine the world in completely different ways. And yet somehow they all end up thinking the same way, too.
Sure.
It's real interesting. And, you know, this play asks and sometimes answers some of those questions, too. So it's – and especially, you know, when young guys talk, sometimes they talk out of, you know, their keisters. So it's really kind of silly, too, how they come up with these ideas, too. So it's – heck, you're talking about genius, but it's silly genius, too. That's right.
Now, Picasso, we know for sure, frequented that place, correct?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who would he, in reality, have run into during that era, do you think?
A variety of sort of bohemian artist types musicians and actors and other and writers and there's a lot of talk in the show actually about the fact that, you know, it's a place where creative types frequent.
Uh-huh.
But there are certainly varying degrees of this person may be an artist, but they're not that artist.
Today that would be Comic-Con.
Yeah.
It could be.
Just kidding. Yeah. But you know, places to go hang out with people of a similar mind, I guess. Was that before his cubism period?
He was into it at that point, but he was still in the, in fact, the play is set at the end of his blue period when he's still sort of formative. And so he's already sort of, you know, developing his style, and it's on the way. It certainly didn't have a name yet, but... yeah, there's a big point of the play is the idea that he needs to move into the next phase of his career and what it takes to sort of springboard him into that. And obviously the play has some very specific ideas that aren't necessarily true to reality. But so much of the play is sort of a debate between great minds about why what they do is important and how alike they are and how similar they are. And I think it sort of comes to a kind of nice agreement about, you know, what it takes to be a genius and what that really means and where talent comes from and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I can just imagine Steve Martin thinking in his mind, what would happen if these two people met and spoke?
Yeah.
What would they argue about? Would Einstein tell him that his cubism form of art was not mathematically correct or something like that?
I would like to think that, you know, he would say, oh, it's all right. It's no relativity theory, but you know, a couple of nice pictures there. Just really try to dig into him too. I think after a while, you know, they become friends, they share a couple drinks, that's when there's like, oh, okay, I can handle a joke. Maybe not at the very beginning. It's that language barrier, too. We all happen to speak English in this play,
true.
Too. It's funny. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny how that works, yeah.
No German, no Spanish. No French,
just a lot of English.
A whole lot of English.
Which you see a lot in, you know, Parisian bars at the turn of the century.
yeah. We're in a Paris bar and they're all speaking English. But you have to take certain liberties to make it understood.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think one of the fun parts of the play is that beyond all the discussions of art and science and heady intellectual topics, I mean, there also are young guys hanging out in a bar and they talk about women and relationships, and there's a lot of sort of verbal sparring with the other patrons in the bar.
Yeah.
And it's so much of the fun of the play is that they're painted as very real people with, you know, beyond the fact that their minds are working at a very high level, they're also, you know, have very natural sort of relationships and that sort of thing. And we see sort of how those things influence what a person becomes too, is just the socializing with other people and who you choose to associate with.
I know he's playing fast and loose with the timeline here. Is there any specific time mentioned in the show?
They say that it's 1904.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. In fact, they give a very specific date. It's October 8th, 1904. But that's only really just to indicate where we are in the timeline as far as when their work is going
even
to be published.
Before World War One. Yeah. Was there any talk of politics or what might have been to come in Europe?
Yeah, there's actually a little fun discussion early in the show where Einstein asks some of the other bar patrons, Picasso hasn't arrived yet, what they think is going to happen throughout the 20th century, because they're sort of talking about the fact that we're at the dawn of a new century. And one character pretty much accurately describes most of the major events that are upcoming in the 20th century, and of course no one believes her.
Who would believe that cigarettes might be banned in restaurants? Who would have believed that?
There's a Woody Allen movie, I can't think of the name right now, but it's set in the future, and supposedly he died and was brought back years from now. I guess cryogenics or something to that effect. It was a Woody Allen movie.
Yeah. Right?
But they asked him about Woody smoking. Allen, and he said, oh, yeah, I'm afraid so. I used to smoke. And the doctor essentially says, oh, best thing for you. We learned that strengthens your life. So you never know what's going to come.
That's great. We're just going over this hump. Cigarettes will be fashionable again in 10 years. You can mark my words.
Somehow I doubt that. But you never know. In the mind of a comedic genius, and I'm going to call him that, of Steve Martin, simply because of the versatility.
Oh, yeah.
He can go from absurd comedy to very serious intellectual comedy, you know, just within the snap of your fingers.
Oh, yeah. And, like, just how it's kind of pieced together. There are these serious conversations that have, you know, you can go all the way to puns to all the way to this just like really prophetic like thought. And I was like, how is he able to slide this all in, you know, such a short time period, since this is a one act play. So we get so many ideas out and so many different things. And, you know, it's Steve Martin, like you said, like he just knows like how the audience is going to respond and what they might need, because he can't just have like, you know, silly puns or slapstick comedy all the time.
Yeah.
He knows it's like, all right, it's got to develop and people have just got to communicate with each other, too. I also realize I'm moving my hands around, too, which does nothing on the radio.
This is that's nothing on the radio, but it's not distracting like it would be on television.
Oh, good. So,
I mean, obviously, I do the same thing. So
I'll just start
have to tone it down. I had to tone it down when I was on television. But this makes for a good way to get past that. We're speaking with Adam Arterbridge, the director, and Emerson Rapp, who plays the role of Albert Einstein in the Steve Martin written play, Picasso at the La Pina Gil, opening this Friday, March the 20th, at the it's a production of the Summit Theater of Lee Summit, opening at the Metropolitan Community College's Longview Cultural Arts Center on the campus of Longview College. The number to call for more information, by the way, is 816-463-2654, and more information and the ability to get tickets at summittheatergroup.com. We're speaking with Adam and Emerson about this play set in a Paris cafe, peopled by intellectuals, where they go to discuss ideas, relax, perhaps reveal some details of their personal lives while all this is going on.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of that, actually. Romantic entanglements are a big part of the play as well.
Was that a problem for Picasso?
He was very involved with the people around him.
That's what I read.
And that is paid off in the play to a great deal. So, yes, he was living a very full life.
That's a very nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're at the end of, as you said earlier, the blue period. He had different. Does this play a big role in his thinking? Does his thinking drastically changes as he goes from his blue period, kind of a down period, I guess you would say, to his cubics period, which people at the time had a hard time understanding. From
yeah, a big part of the, actually the drive of this particular show is him sort of reaching inspiration to move into the next phase of his work. Once he enters the stage, he spends a lot of time talking about how there's an idea coming, but he can't figure out what it is yet. And then by the end of the show, we get to see what that idea is and how that changes him as a person. And he changes pretty drastically. I think for the positive, but you get to see what happens when a truly creative person is inspired and how that affects just everything about them. He goes, I think the character's through line really is that he starts off very inwardly focused. It's all about what's happening to him and how he can get what he wants. And by the end, he's thinking much more about what he can do for the rest of the world by applying his art, what that means to everyone else. And I think that's a very powerful kind of message, really, that, you know, it's a young man can stop focusing on what he wants and start seeing that if he does something right, there'll be something of value to everyone. Obviously, the play kind of plays fast and loose with people recognizing their own inherent greatness. It's hard to do with a real person, but in the course of the show, I mean, it's pretty quickly referred to that both of these two men, Einstein and Picasso, are geniuses, and everyone sort of recognizes it. But what that really means becomes sort of the crux of much of the discussion of the play.
You know, the same thing might be said of Einstein, just on the cusp of a big discovery.
Oh yeah, and I think at the time period of where he's at, he has the ideas, but he's almost afraid to share them. Like, he's at this one point where he has the ideas, but he's kind of stuck in, like, the everyday rut. You know, sounds very familiar if you're an actor or an artist, and it's like, oh, I got to do the 9-to-5, but I have these great ideas I want to promote. And this was right before he, published his special theory of relativity while he was working at the patent office.
Yeah, a patent office. Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
And, you know, he did it. He didn't like it. It's like, oh, I can do this. He's just not enthusiastic about it, too. I think a lot of people feel that way, too. And they can recognize, like, oh, yeah, you got to do that, but I still have these great ideas, too. And people were just starting to poke and prod him. It's like, so what do you do? Or, like, what do you do during the day? What do you do at night? And that's when his inspiration comes out. So, you know, I think throughout this entire course at the bar, he becomes inspired to start sharing his ideas. And it's like, all right, now I feel confident that I feel like people understand, or people want to understand this too. And it's just not, you know, his crazy ramblings. He knew something was up. So he was ready to share with the world.
See, if this were happening in reality, I can imagine Picasso maybe on a napkin jotting down some drawings, maybe. Uh-huh. And Einstein doing math on his.
Yeah, there's actually a great moment in the show where they decide to have a little competition to see who's got the better work. And it's played to great comic effect. But yeah, it's neither of them really understand each other's what they've created. They see that it has value for the most part, but it doesn't mean anything to anyone. In fact, to go along with what Emerson was saying, it is funny that, you know, most of the other characters in the show really don't understand what he's talking about. They are interested, but when he actually blurts out the sort of thesis of his work, there's a great comic moment, and all of them just look at him blankly because they have no idea what it means or what that could possibly. They can't comprehend it at all because it's not only so new, no one else has thought of it except him.
Yeah, we've all met people like that. Yeah. You sense that there's something special there, but you're not sure what it is or how it's going to fit in. Some geniuses never really fit in, and unfortunately, sometimes their work, their theories, they never really materialize. Yeah. And that's kind of sad, really.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a lot of people that can just kind of walk into a room and you have that wow moment with other people. It's like, he's got something going on, too. I mean, you know, as soon as I walked in the studio, Michael, I had this wow moment with you. It was just genius right there.
Well,
but you're absolutely right. It's like, all right, it's like, not only are you art, you know, you might be an artist, you might be a quote-unquote genius, but how do you promote that? How do you sell that? Or
yeah, I don't put it into the promos.
No.
I really don't. But interesting. And so who would have, in reality, who would have frequented the Lapina Gym. It would have been poets, writers, intellectuals, probably a lot of political thinkers.
Oh, absolutely. Like, you know, you have just everyday people that want to go there for a drink, and then you'd have poets that just want to sit there, maybe try to find a patron who's like, hey, like, while I sit and think, you might want to, you know, lubricate me up. I might come up with ideas a little more, too. You always might have, you know, well, you always got to find the money in art, too. That's something that
that's,
I think
that is true.
It's true. And there's actually a character in the show who sort of represents that side of things, who's a dealer who comes in. I mean, is there specifically to find artists and to buy their work. And so there's a little bit of homage paid to that sort of side of the world, too. Not necessarily that it's as important as creating great works, but that, you know, someone's got to see them, or it doesn't ever mean anything.
Yeah, so. If it doesn't become known, it's just lost in an attic somewhere. Yeah. And eventually gets thrown away, which it's sad, but it makes you wonder how many great works of art actually were thrown away because no one recognized what it might have been.
Oh, I would like to think, well, hopefully everything that's been thrown away is somewhere stored in an attic of mine somewhere. So it just takes a little bit of searching. Oh, just a little bit of searching, you know?
just to find that and then become rich by selling them now.
Of course.
Of course, the artist that originally did it got nothing out of it, which is probably usually the case.
They probably got a drink or two. I mean, if we're talking about the La Pinal Jus, like, all right. How about a bottle of wine for you?
The play is called Picasso at the Lapina GL. It opens this Friday night, the 20th of March. At 7:30 p.m. On the campus of the Metropolitan Community College Longview campus, which is it's south part of town. 470 is just north of the campus.
That's correct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. What is the turnoff road?
You want to get off of View High Drive.
At View High Drive.
Yep. That'll take you right down there.
Take you right down to the campus. Performances continue then on Saturday, the 21st, and then they take a break. Oh. Only two shows and then a break, but that's the way they scheduled it.
We wear ourselves out. It's exhausting.
Oh, yeah.
Sweating bullets after that, let me tell you.
Shows continue then Friday the 27th at 7:30, Saturday the 28th at 7:30, a matinee on Sunday afternoon the 29th at 2:30 p.m. at, of course, the Longview campus of Longview College in the Cultural Arts Center down there. The number to call, the theater hotline, as they write it down here, is 816-463-2654. And a lot of this information can be found online at Summit Theater Group. Summit, as if you were spelling Lee Summit, only knock off the Lees. SummitTheaterGroup.com for more information. I guess they can also probably get tickets linked from that website as well.
Yeah. If you go to the website, I think the new website is summittheater.org. I want to say they just launched a new one, but yeah, if you go there, there's a link for tickets.
Okay.
Real easy to find.
Try both of them.
Yeah.
I want to help you out there. It's in their fourth year, and this year I know they have shows at several different locations on the Longview campus and at other locations as well.
Yeah, there's going to be several shows around the Lee Summit area. There's a couple shows there at the Longview campus. They're doing one show at the Pavilion at Paradise Park. A couple shows there, actually. Some bigger shows in the summer. We're actually doing assisting with the production for the Lee Summit 150th anniversary celebration as well. Yeah. And then we're doing a... there'll be a big production of Bye Bye Birdie later in the summer as well.
Yep. And will that be outdoors?
Indoors? That's going to be outdoors. Yeah, I believe so. I think it's semi-covered. I haven't been over there. But and then we've got auditions coming up next month for Stephen Sondheim's Assassins.
Yes. With some political undertones.
Yeah, a little bit. Well. Yeah,
but a nice variety in schedule. Mm-hmm. Lee Summit went for several years without any presence in the community theater field. But they're coming back now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Glad to say it's a nice market. Well, what do you have coming up yourself following this show? I always like to touch base with the performers and directors on this.
Well, after this show, my next production, I'll be directing Blithe Spirit at City Theater of Independence in November.
Uh-huh.
That's my next gig.
Now that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, you have to find a really good Madame Arcot.
I know. I'm hoping we get some great people out for that. So if you're listening, everyone, come join us.
Especially if you have if you have a good British accent. I've seen it done with some really fine British accents.
Yeah, we're hoping to have a lot of fun with it and really make it quality.
Now, what about Emerson? What do you have coming up?
Well, after this, I'm going to take my beautiful wife to Paris, France for our honeymoon.
I bet you go to the Lapina Gio.
Oh, you better believe that we're going to go there. Have a bottle or five there. It's going to be fantastic. But then for the Fringe Fest that's coming up in July, I'm going to be doing some writing and acting for Bottoms Up Sketch Comedy. So that's, you know, my baby. And hopefully, if you guys want to laugh more, or if you see the show, obviously, which you're listening to this, you are going to come see the show. If you find me funny, you got to come out to the Fringe Festival and, you know, keep watching the funny.
And you've been in the Fringe Festival before.
Yes,
In fact, in your credits, did I read your credits? The Who's Tommy at the Met, the Fringe Festival, and local film credits as well. So you've done the Fringe before?
Yes, I have. And let me tell you, out of everything that happens here for local artists, local performers, writers, directors, it's a great way to experiment. It's a great way to get your art out. And, you know, if it wasn't for the Fringe Festival, I made a video called Tour of Kansas City where I told people where to get barbecue. It was just to promote the live show for the Kansas City Fringe Festival. If it wasn't for them, I would have never had the time to make that video. And it's really what's got the word out for our sketch comedy troupe. So I'm glad for the Fringe Festival.
Oh, what do you think of Oklahoma Joe's changing their name? A bad move, in my opinion.
Oh, hey, you know what? They're not changing the food, so I can handle that.
Even though it's in Kansas City, you can still call it Oklahoma Joe's. Yeah. Come on.
Call it, yeah, what is it? Joe's KC?
Something like that.
The restaurant formerly known as Oklahoma Joe's.
Not nearly as much fun, in my opinion. Well, God, you know, barbecue is big in Kansas City.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. As is theater anymore, lots of fine groups going around the area. And great to have Summit Theater in that mix as well. So Picasso at the Lapina Gil, written by comedian, actor, intellectual, Steve Martin. I think I mentioned it earlier. He has a banjo group, and they came through the area within the past couple of years. I think he played the Uptown Theater. So multi-talented. You need a little break from all that intellectual stuff. So
right, right. Yeah.
Play the banjo.
A little bit of lowbrow once in a while.
A little lowbrow. That's right. Show's open this Friday the 20th. Performances continue on the 21st. Then a second weekend as well, Friday the 27th, Saturday the 28th, a matinee on Sunday the 29th at the campus of Longview College in the Cultural Arts Center. Once again, the number to call for more information, the theater hotline, is 816-463-2654 or online at summittheatergroup.com or org.
You'll get there eventually. Yeah.
Chances are if you
Google
do one
does
or the
wonders,
other,
right?
Chances are if you do one or the other, it'll correct and go to the correct
place. You'll get to
the
right place.
Nice to have you with us here on the show today. Adam Arterbridge, the director, and Emerson Rapp, who has the challenging role of Albert Einstein. You got to get all that math straight in your head.
All that math.
In the play Picasso at the Lapina Gil, an actual place in Paris, opening this Friday at the Summit Theater Group. Of Lee Summit. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a break. When we return, much more to bring your way. More of an intellectual variety. This is intellectual day on the show.
All right.
So I should have taken the week off, I suppose. When we return, you're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI. 90.1 FM.
Freeze Frame! Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. Unapologetically old-fashioned, Disney's live-action adaptation of Cinderella is a sweet-natured, visually dazzling treat for young girls and all the family members who will tag along with them. Lily James, best known as Lady Rose from TV's Downton Abbey, makes for a lovely girl of the cinders, and Kate Blanchett, who can do no wrong, is her gloriously toxic stepmother. While it's more than a bit maudlin and the pace occasionally drags, Kenneth Branagh's sincere version of the classic fairy tale has a lot of heart and humor, and the production values are top-notch. It's hard to dislike a movie whose mantra is, have courage and be kind. Take the kids and the Kleenex. I can't imagine a movie any less like Cinderella than the sleazy and ultra-violent crime thriller Run All Night. Liam Neeson plays a hitman for a New York Irish mob who tries to protect his innocent son, Joel Kinnaman, from being knocked off by Liam's former boss, played by Ed Harris. Ed employs another professional killer, played by Common, to take both of them out. There are some showy directorial flourishes that give the movie a bit of style, and the cast is well above grade for the material. But it all seems very familiar and a bit awkward, sort of like a 70s grindhouse movie you remember in a dream. The 2 hours you spend seeing Run All Night might seem like all night. Also opening this week, Ballet 422 is a documentary peek at the world of professional ballet, focusing on the creation of the New York City Ballet's 422nd original piece. Red Army is a documentary about the Soviet Union's Cold War hockey dynasty. And The Salvation is a violent Western revenge tale starring Mads Mikkelsen and Ava Green. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI FM. Freeze Frame!
This is Maria Vasquez Boyd, host and producer of ArtSpeak Radio, inviting you to tune in to ArtSpeak Radio at our new time, Wednesday at noon to 1 p.m. That's right, from noon to 1 p.m. on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
30 millions of people begirding themselves with deadly weapons and falling into antagonistic battle lines. All that was comprehended in one word. War.
The untold story of Irish wilderness Missouri on From Ark to Microchip, Wednesday night at 11:30.
Hey, this is your old pal Mike Murphy. Have you ever heard of the San Patricios? They were a group of Irish and other immigrants from Europe who came to this country during the 1840s, only to end up fighting on the Mexican side during the Mexican-American War. They didn't get much press, but for some reason, there's an awful lot of songs about them. This Wednesday from 6 to 8 a.m., be featuring that music with David Rovix, Tim O'Brien, The Elders, The Chieftains, Black 47, and more.
Hi, this is Mike Murphy. The last time I saw Rob Amerine was at the Elders KKFI benefit back in December, and Rob asked me if I'd be the contact person to announce his funeral arrangements. Well, unfortunately, that day is here. Rob passed away on February 26th, and his funeral will be at All Souls UU Church on March 20th. Light refreshments start at 2, followed by a memorial at 3, and a wake and reception at 4. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI. Kansas City Community Radio.
Our best to Rob and his family. I remember meeting him at, it was either a powwow or a solstice celebration or something of that variety. But my best to him and his family. Yes, tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day. Lots of activities going to be going on in as the parade makes its way down to the Westport area of town. You be careful out there. We don't want any policemen chasing crowds like we saw out of our window of the radio station last year. Let's keep it sane and in charge, okay? So, but have fun, of course, on St. Patrick's Day, which is tomorrow. Well, I guess celebrating the day that all the snakes were driven out of Ireland or something like that. Welcome back to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. We're going to talk to a local book author. She has also written plays, things of that nature. She is the author of, for instance, Now We Can All Go Home, three novellas in homage to Chekhov. And she also teaches at UMKC. She has written previous writing, both fiction and plays, The Clay That Breathes, Secret Lives. I like the title of that right now. Secret Lives. Sounds like a lot of fun. The Heart, a Helicon 9 edition, and Café du Monde. Now, is that named after the place in New Orleans?
It isn't.
It is not? Okay. I've been to the place in New Orleans.
I have too. Wonderful place. This is totally different.
Catherine Browder is her name. Playwright, actress, grew up here in the Midwest, but has lived in many places. England, Japan, Taiwan. Her plays have been produced regionally at the Hot Link New Play Festival in New York City, and most recently at the 2014 Kansas City Fringe Festival. Teaches creative writing at UMKC, is an advisory editor for New Letters Magazine, where her book reviews often appear. Her award-winning stories have appeared in Kansas Quarterly, Nimrod, Plowshares, Prairie Schooner, and Kansas City Noir. Oh, that's my favorite kind of movies, Noah. It really is. And appeared elsewhere as well. We welcome Catherine to the show.
Thank you.
The life of a book author, you spend a lot of time probably by yourself typing on the computer keys.
Yes, you have to be happy sitting down,
that's
I'd
right.
say.
Do things just flow when you're in a good
they do.
Way of going?
After a while, they flow, because you're always surprised what will come out when you're paying attention and you're either writing longhand or typing, things do come. And that is, I think, the creative process.
Now, were you a fan of Chekhov, for instance? Did you enjoy The Seagull when they repeated Seagull?
I did. They did it quite some time ago. And more recently, in fact, the Metropolitan Ensemble Theater, did it like 3 years ago. And they did a lovely production, which I, of course, was thrilled to see.
Sure.
And in fact, the UMKC graduate acting program has done Three Sisters twice in the last 10 years. It's a perfect play for graduate women. It's got four fabulous roles for women and also young men. So it's an ideal play. I really got back into Chekhov only when I started to teach at UMKC, and I was teaching fiction writing or prose form, so there was a little flirting with the plays as well. But you just become... Chekhov is just kind of a god for some of us. He was so such an innovator for both short fiction and plays that the more you read him, the more you realize how many other people he's influenced. I've read people say that the natural descendant of Chekhov would be Raymond Carver.
Oh, okay.
And other people, I think Alice Munro is one of his descendants, and there are any number of writers you can think of that seem to naturally come from his new way of telling a story, which was pulled back. It was more objective. It was less emotionalism, more selective in the details, writing life as it is, both the plays and in terms of the plays, there was less melodrama. Quite a bit less. And he was sort of breaking new ground from the traditional Russian theater, which was bombastic.
Uh-huh.
And actresses and actors declaimed, and he wanted subtlety. You know, it was like you were watching a film, sort of life as it is, not artifice. Less artifice, more naturalism.
So he really didn't like to take a definitive stand. He just wanted it to flow and let you make up your own mind.
His plays all sort of end abruptly, which is what is a real teaser for any writer. If a play just ends abruptly, you're thinking, oh my God, what's going to happen to Irina? Her fiance was just killed in a duel. Pow, the play ends. So for someone like me and writers who are always thinking, what if? I kept thinking, this might be a good project. So I started with Irina and made my way through the Three Sisters, each sister in turn, writing, okay, what's their life now after the curtain has come down? For Irina, I wrote immediately after the event, and then for her sisters months later, and her brother quite a few months later after the play. These are people who were kind of in a dying aristocracy. They're not even aristocrats. They're kind of poor landed gentry. But they're cultivated and they're educated, and they are totally defenseless against the new new middle class that's coming in. People who have a more mercantile attitude towards life. And these people are the sort that says, oh, money, I don't talk about money.
Oh.
And of course they're losing it all because they won't face reality. These
sure.
are people who won't face reality, but they're totally likable, flaws and all, because they're survivors. They will survive. Not perhaps graciously, but they will survive. So you wanted to kind of think, okay, how are they going to survive?
So you saw, you wanted more.
I wanted more.
So if you could talk to Chekhov, you would say, what, was there a sequel you never got to? Was that
oh,
sort
give
of
us
the
a
thing?
Fifth act, please.
So you decided to do that.
I would write the fifth act. That's kind of it. Just and it had to be, it seemed to me, it really should be in fictional form. To do it in play form, you would invite comparison, which would be awful. I mean, who could imitate? And I didn't want to imitate the style. I'm not writing like Chekhov.
Uh-huh.
I'm just inspired by his characters. And besides, when you write in fiction, you can do flashbacks. You can give a backstory. You can flesh out characters who were otherwise just presented to you. There's a beautiful character in Uncle Vanya called Yelena.
Uh-huh.
And she's married to an elderly man. She's a musician. She married this elderly man, I think, because she thought he was fascinating and her life was boring. All the men in the show think of her as a kind of, for lack of a better expression, dumb blonde. Well, she isn't a dumb blonde, I don't think. This is a woman trained at the St. Petersburg Conservatory of Music. She simply made a bad decision. And so two of the other younger male characters are they fall in love with her, one superficially and one truly, because their lives are so boring. They project onto her what they want to see. And so what fun it is to give her her own life and her own point of view towards all of this unwanted attention. I think many beautiful women get a lot of unwanted attention because that's what happens when you're beautiful.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
Nor would I. But I think it happens. And it's pestering, perhaps. And it's today it might be even... We would have other words for it today.
What does that say about Chekhov, do you think? Did he recognize that fact?
I think he did, because there was a young, in one of his letters, there's a letter to him from a young actress in a provincial theater who wrote to him and said, I don't believe Yelena is witless. What is your opinion? I think she's a fuller person. And he apparently wrote back and said, you're right. So... But he is not going to take a stand. This is the thing about Chekhov. Yeah. He is presenting. He is pulled back. He is detached. He's not taking a stand. And this is so captivating to me to have a writer who is presenting all of these characters and may like them a great deal, but is not hedging his bets. He's not weighing one character against another. He's presenting the situation. And as a result, the characterizations just pop out at you because he hasn't tipped his hand or played favorites or anything. They are who they are.
Yeah, no. This is with Uncle Vanya. So there are three novellas. So I take it that you did this three times with
I did it three times. Uh-huh. He has considers to have four major plays. There are a couple of others that are that came before these four. But by the time I got to the fourth and last play, I'd run out of steam.
Sure.
And I said, okay, the book's long enough. I don't want to handle the cherry
you can
orchard.
You can always do more, Catherine.
Well, later.
You can finish off the cherry orchard someday.
Right. But, that's interesting. The one character I would have liked to have done in the cherry orchard was... A character named Lopatkin, and he was a businessman, and he came up through the ranks, a poor kid who was treated well by the landowner, the mistress of the house, and is now her business manager and clearly in love with her in a distant, admiring way. But he's considered venal. He's considered kind of the villain of the piece because he keeps telling them, folks, you've got to sell the cherry orchard. You are so much in arrears. You can't pay the mortgage. You're going to lose it all. Please sell off the cherry orchard and you can save the house and the estate. Nobody's listening to him. He's the one realist in the bunch. Nobody's listening. And by God, they lose it. And he ends up buying it. Somebody had to buy it. And I'm sure he did it for emotional reasons as well, but he's still kind of seen as the villainous or quasi-villainous businessman.
Sure.
The nouveau riche. But he is really fascinating because there's a lot there, and he's the only realist surrounded by all these idealists who refuse to make a decision.
Oh. Well, that, you have a good point there. That sort of kind of follows, doesn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Well, so it's three novellas. We've covered the first one. What would be the second
one? The second one is Uncle Vanya is the first. The second is Three Sisters. And that I began with Three Sisters. That began the project. But I went back in the later months before it was published and made some additions. The middle sister, Masha, has a husband that's also a kind of boring school teacher. And she's not in love with him. She's fallen in love with a colonel that's left. He has to leave with his battery, his battalion. But I've always liked the husband, even though he's a bit of a clown and a fool. And he adores his wife, but he can't seem to get out of the Latin teacher frame of mind. So I have it constructed a conceit in which he's going to try and woo his wife back.
Ah.
She doesn't know it's happening. He's sort of disguised himself as this person on the bridge. She's always going for long walks and he encounters this person she met. She has made up her own mind what he is. She doesn't know it's her husband. But that's just a short conceit. But also interesting to me is the brother, who's kind of a ne'er-do-well accidentally. He marries a young local woman, and she's turned out to be this ambitious shrew. She's what some critics call a despoiler. It seemed like Chekhov always had a character who was despoiling, who was robbing them of things.
He probably knew people like that who
didn't care
much for them.
Well, he did. He had friends who broke with him briefly because they could see themselves being patterned in themselves patterned into story.
See, writers can do that. They can exercise those demons or get even with people by creating a fictional character. I often wonder if that doesn't happen more than I think it does.
Well, it probably does inadvertently.
Yes.
Unconsciously gets slipped in. Apparently, his father was a total hypocrite and ne'er-do-well small town shop owner, and there are stories about him, his cheapness, and apparently one writer and critic has pointed out that he does a wonderful job with that kind of hypocrite in all of his stories.
Well, if you know one,
he is an expert. He grew up with one, so
sure.
Very interesting.
Sure. What was the third novella?
It is The Seagull. Which was actually the first of the great ones.
It's a great story.
It is a lovely story. And I've just chosen one person to tell the story, and that is Dr. Dorn, who I think is probably the only relatively contented character in all of his plays. There is a pattern that his doctors tend to be slightly cynical and idealistic. But this doctor was kind of knew everybody by the lake. He was involved in everyone's life in the way a community is. People turned to him. The young people turned to him as kind of a surrogate, the good old uncle, surrogate dad. He supported the young people. And there is an intimation that at one time he had an affair with maybe one or two of the other characters. You just don't know. It's not necessarily spelled out. But I think he was a person that had a certain perspective on the entire community. After one of the young characters, the young man at the very end of the play, if you remember, he kills himself, and that's the end of the play. And it's Dr. Dorn basically has the last line, get his mother out of here. And then the curtain comes down. Mm-hmm. So I thought, this guy's perfect. He has that perspective that nobody else has. And I like him. So I thought, well, I like him. Why can't I do it from his point of view?
Yeah.
So,
you think Chekhov would have liked your endings?
I don't know. He didn't. Those endings are not. They continue the story, but I don't consider them to be conclusive. Uh-huh. They're just a continuation.
Well, I guess my thinking, and this is just me, he wanted the audience to perhaps consider a conclusion. So what
easily.
You did would follow right along with that.
I've just extended the length of the play, like I said, kind of the fifth act.
Sure.
But it was, for me, it was fun. I just sort of wanted to know. And then, of course, the other retort to people ask, why do you do this? And I don't know. Why not?
Well,
they're there.
Why not? People have finished Beethoven's Unfinished Symphony.
Well, and you know, there are people who've turned Shakespeare characters into novels.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I just read a short story by Rose Tremain in which she imagined Daphne du Maurier meeting a woman and seducing her, actually, a housekeeper at a famous house in England, and then turning, and they have a long affair, and then she turns this housekeeper into the villainous housekeeper of Rebecca. And this real, quote-unquote, real housekeeper reads the story and is shocked, because they had a very warm relationship. Well, she had been used, and she didn't realize it. And it's a wonderful conceit, a wonderful idea. And I haven't read it, but The Wide Sargasso Sea, which is written in the 50s by Jean Rhys, is imagining Rochester, from Jane Eyre, Rochester's crazy wife, imagining her previous life before she became his wife, and her background. It's sort of a yeah, it's a pre-story, whatever you want to call that.
Sure. Sure. Speaking with Catherine Broder, writer, author, has written plays and books as well. We're talking about her latest work, Now We Can All Go Home. I understand the title now. Three novellas paying homage to Chekhov. Where would it be available? It's a UMKC Press, I see here.
It is. It is. It's available online. It's available through Bookmark Press, who is the publisher. And Bookmark Press is a UMKC Press. I'm not sure how readily available it is at local bookstores, but can be ordered through any of them.
Sure. Are you into this? I can't think of the name right now, but some of the authors local get on. And the novel is essentially bought online. They can download a copy.
This is not actually available right now as an ebook, but it is available through online sources, Amazon and whatnot.
We're speaking with Catherine Broder about her new book and all that goes into that. I know you wanted to read some passages from your book for us. What would you like to enlighten us with?
Well, here I'm especially fond of poor Andre, the henpecked husband.
Okay, and a lot of people would identify.
What I've done that Chekhov would not have done is kind of give him a kind of partially platonic love interest. I mean, his life has been so stripped by this overbearing, shrewish wife, this despoiler, that he needed something to lift him up. It's not going to change anything. But this is the opening to the section in the middle novella, the title novella, which is about Andre. It takes place in December. The actual play ends in October, and this is December. I'd like to say you do not need to know Chekhov, and you do not need to know the plays to enjoy this book. I do not assume people know it. I give enough background, so just enjoy them for what they are here. But you don't have to know them at all. You don't have to be familiar with Chekhov or the plays to enjoy this. So this is December, and this is from Andre's point of view, and it's just the opening of his section. The jangle of harness bells drew Andre to the study window. A troika stood in the yard with some poor child holding the horses. Had his wife known what he could see from this very window, her illicit comings and goings and those of her guests, Natasha might have thought better of moving him into this back room. Protopopov slowly emerged from the carriage, adjusting the buttons on an expensive top coat, and lumbered toward the house. Each time the man arrived, he struck Andre as more ursine than the week before. A heavy, bearded head atop a heavy body, balanced on startlingly narrow feet. Andre no longer bothered to use his name. As soon as Protopopov's carriage pulled up to the house, he thought, "The bear is here again." In the beginning, Andre had actually believed the man was extending the hand of friendship until Natasha's fluttering laughter put such foolishness to rest. Andre glanced at his watch and smiled. Any minute, and then bliss. Within seconds, Andre could make out Natasha's laugh, the sound lurching up the stairs, down the hall, and into his room like an inebriated guest. He couldn't remember his sisters laughing with such wantonness, nor could he remember them dressed in bodices cut so low that one was forced to stare at a hillock of flesh. Andre sighed, turned away from the window. Why deny it? His wife made him shudder.
So if you've ever wondered how this story or the two other ones would have ended had Chekhov decided to give it a few more pages,
right?
You have Catherine to tie all the ends together for you here.
And I'm not sure the ends are tied. They're just sort of prolonged.
Okay.
You know, he would not. It's true. There is more of a sense of tying up or extending until you get a little more satisfaction. I guess I just wanted to keep on going because he doesn't. He is just, boom, over those plays.
Well, you know, he might have just gotten tired of it by that point. Rather than extend it and have the last few chapters be rather boring, I'm just going to end it right here.
It could be.
Who knows what was going on in his mind.
We do not know. And died a premature death, I must say.
Do you have ideas to do more of Chekhov or other books?
I don't think so. No. I think this was this consumed me for a long time, and I truly enjoyed it, actually, to sit down and just, it required reading, and then you'd read it again from a different point of view, and the read it again from a different sister's point of view, read it again from a doctor's point of view.
Sure.
And in order to feel like you could enter that person, and then I did a lot of reading about Chekhov and biographies and his letters. His letters are fantastic. I mean, that's the day when people did do letters, and he was a prolific letter writer. And you just learn so much about him from his letters and all of his correspondence. And I guess now it would be fun to read letters to him, but people, I haven't done that. I haven't extended the research to that.
Sure. Now, once again, how do people get the book?
Well, you could go online. You could contact UMKC. You could go to your favorite bookstore. And if it's not on the shelf, you can ask for it.
And it's a B-R-O-W-D-E-R, Catherine with a C.
Correct.
And that's how, and the title is Now We Can All Go Home, Three Novellas in Homage to Chekhov. It's a UMKC Press production. Do you have a website?
I do. It's Catherine at CatherineBrowder.com.
Okay, CatherineBrowder.com. That's right. You can go there and read about it and probably learn where you can go to get the book from there.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, are the students just as bright at UMKC this year?
Well, they're always bright. I mean, the thing about, you know, teaching students is they end up teaching you. You get sort of revitalized as they are learning to write. Having to formulate, I deferred teaching creative writing for a long time, and so I did it quite late, and what happens is it forces you to clarify how you do your own writing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Telling us about her new book. If you've ever wondered or had a thirst for more of these Chekhov stories, Catherine has filled that gap for you. The title, once again, is How We Can, Now We Can All Go Home, in other words, Be Satisfied. Three novellas in homage to Chekhov. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.